Welcome back, everybody, to a new episode of Kicking with Keeler here on Full Press Radio, episode number 86. Most likely our last episode in July, although you never know, we might be back on the 31st, we'll see, but this looks like be our last episode of July. I'm your host, Ricky Keeler. Glad to be back with you once again this week. Hope you're all staying safe out there. We have so much sports to get into over the next hour, and we actually have guests for you this week. I know you've heard my voice a lot over the last couple weeks, but I actually have some guests on this week. We're going to be talking Texas and Oklahoma potentially going to the SEC. Josh Neighbors from Locked On Big 12 is going to join us to talk about what the Big 12 maybe could have done and what it affects with the conference. Is it better that they expand, or is it just inevitable that they're going to kind of disintegrate and the other teams go to prospective conferences? We'll dive into that. Adam Kierzenblatt from the Hockey Writers and also the Third Line podcast will join us. We had the NHL expansion draft and the NHL draft this week, but I wanted to get an insight on the Seattle Kraken, the buzz around there, and this new team. So he's going to join us. We'll talk Aaron Rodgers. We'll talk new NFL guidelines in terms of vaccines and what that means. Players being upset about it. Coaches being upset about it. Some coaches losing their jobs. We're going to get into that. NBA draft is this week. Baseball trade deadline is this week. Just so much. It's hard to contain it over the next hour, hour and a half. We're going to try as best we can. Of course, the shocker at the Olympics. I don't know if it's that much of a shocker, but we'll dive into that, what happened early Sunday morning with Team USA. Not a good loss by any means. But want to remind you, you can follow us on Twitter, at Rickinator555, at FP underscore coverage, at Full Press Radio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Just search Kicking with Keeler. Chances are you will find the podcast. Please give your thoughts. Tell me what you like, what you don't like. I'm always open to feedback. I'd appreciate it. And you can also email me, rickjkeeler@gmail.com. Remember, download the Full Press Coverage app for all on your iOS or Android device. It is free. It gives you all of our articles, our podcasts, our live shows. It's got everything for you, and it's really easy to download, so be sure to download that today. But we're going to start with the NBA. The Milwaukee Bucks are your NBA champions, a 105-98 win in Game 6 earlier last week on Tuesday. And to me, when I look at this, it was inevitable the Bucks were going to win, I think, for a couple of reasons. It's kind of hard to ignore the elephant in the room that Scott Foster was reffing this game. And I'm not... Don't get me wrong, I'm not accusing the NBA of any means of anything foul play with the game. I'm not doing that. But it's kind of weird. I would think you would think the same thing out there, that two of the four Bucks wins were Scott Foster-officiated games, and Chris Paul doesn't have a good record in Scott Foster-officiated games. That's not the reason the Suns lost by any means. The officiating was great in these series. It is something to put in the back of your mind. But it's all Milwaukee, and it's all Giannis. Because to me, when you look at Giannis Antetokounmpo, I'm surprised I said that actually without mumbling it, he played the game of his life. And he played, I think, the way that his game fits. And people say, well, Giannis isn't a three-point shooter. Giannis is not a complete player. But what's important for a star like him is not to play outside of what you're comfortable with. Teams want you to play outside your comfort zone. They want you to shoot the three. They want you to be more of a perimeter player because it's limiting what your strength is. If Giannis just plays to his strengths, he's hard to stop. He just gets in the paint at ease, gets to the free throw line. He hits his free throws. You saw it in Game 6. He was 17 for 19 from the line. Most nights you're setting him to the line 19 times. He might only make 8. Maybe 10 if he gets lucky. Shoots about 50-55%. 17 from 19 from the line. 50 points, 14 rebounds, including 4 offensive boards. And I look at this as a exclamation point for him. Everyone's talking about how overrated he is. He can't win in Milwaukee. He can't be the number one in Milwaukee. He needs to be the number two. They need to get a number one. He kind of put that all to bed, really. I don't think you can say that anymore. Just by the way he played during the series. And think about it, a couple weeks ago, when he had that injury against Atlanta, nobody thought he was going to come back. And he not only came back, he got better as the series went on against Phoenix. Even when they lost games 1 and 2, he looked good in those games. Chris Middleton had his on and off moments, but every time Chris Middleton needed to hit a big shot, it seemed like he made it. You had Bobby Portis with 16 off the bench. And I think what did Phoenix in this series, it wasn't Chris Paul. I don't put this on Chris Paul. I don't think it changed his legacy. We kind of talked about that last week after Phoenix lost Game 5. I don't think it's on Devin Booker, even though Booker went 0 for 7 from 3 in Game 6. Booker did everything he could in a lot of these games. At times carried the Suns' offense. I don't put this on him either. If there's any criticism for Monty Williams, if any, I don't think there's much, they didn't have a bench. Now, Milwaukee didn't have a bench either. You think about the Bucks played 8 guys for most of the series. Phoenix played 9, and largely because DeAndre Ayton was in foul trouble, they tried Frank Kaminsky out. It actually worked in the fourth quarter. Kaminsky did really good early on, and it made you wonder, okay, if Kaminsky's playing this well, why wasn't he used for the other parts in that series? Because really, if you take out the 1 minute that Craig played for Phoenix, they only played 8 guys as well. And Cam Payne had his good moments. Cameron Johnson went 1 for 5 from the floor in 16 minutes. They need a little bit more from him. It's kind of that collective group, and that's, I think, what made Phoenix successful. Not just that Booker was having a great playoffs and Chris Paul was having a great playoffs and playing like he's 10 years younger. It was that they were getting contributions from everybody. Guys like Bridges. Ayton was playing well, and Ayton didn't exactly have the greatest Game 6 either. It was 4 for 12 shooting and 12.6 rebounds. But he got into foul trouble. That really did him in, because what Milwaukee did really well against Atlanta in those last two games that they won, and then against Phoenix, their ability to get in the paint, their ability to just drive the ball down low. They don't rely on the three-point shot, and it's kind of a different way of playing basketball. It's kind of refreshing in a way, because we're used to seeing teams chuck up about 40 threes a game. Now, both teams shot about 25-plus threes in Game 6, and they combined to shoot 12 for 52. So it's kind of when you're playing good old-fashioned two-point basketball, kind of saw it with, I'll give you Milwaukee-Brooklyn Game 3 as an example, but that was just bad shooting. I mean, both teams shot about 44-45%. Not great, not terrible, though. It wasn't like defense caught. It was more defense causing missed shots than just strictly everybody missing shots. I was trying to think about this. Is it the luckiest road to a championship? I think so. I don't think it's the luckiest one ever. It's up there. But what matters is who won the championship. They're not going to look back and tell you that. They're not going to look back and tell you that everybody's championship is equal. It's not. It looks equal, but when you think about the circumstances, I mean, Kevin Durant is one shoe size too small. The Nets beat them. I think, and I've said this before, if James Harden is at least 75 to 80% healthy and Kyrie Irving's healthy, I think the Nets win that series. Trae Young gets hurt in Game 4 for the Hawks. I think no Trae Young for the Hawks hurts more than no Giannis for the Bucks. Which is weird to say that, but I do believe that. So I think that cost Atlanta. That series would have gone 7, I think, if Trae Young was there. And I don't think, but there was no luck in this Phoenix series. I mean, to be down 0-2 and to win 4 of your last 5, to win 4 in a row. You don't see, the last time we saw that was really what happened with Dwayne Wade and Shaq with the Heat. It's not often you see a team come back from 0-2 in the finals. Even though you would think it's not over until the road team wins the series, you got to Game 5 without the road team winning game in the series. Can Milwaukee repeat next year? It's possible. I mean, I liked also the way Jrue Holiday played, with 12 points, 11 assists, 9 rebounds, very good defensively. I think his impact was more felt defensively than offensively. It's possible, but you got to think who's going to get better. Brooklyn's going to have the big three, you would think, healthy. We'll see what happens with Ben Simmons, but if Philly, I think Philly'd only get rid of Simmons if they got maybe not a comparable player, but a really good player. So you would think Doc Rivers in Philly would be around. There's the rumor that potentially Bradley Beal would want to go to Boston. I think that would play a huge impact if Beal went there. You got the Lakers. You know LeBron and AD want to add somebody else. You got the Clippers. Phoenix will be back. Utah will be back. Denver, I think, will be back. Golden State, if Klay Thompson's healthy and you've got two first-round picks, could they trade to get an impact player, a veteran in the mix? Golden State should be back. There's great competition in the NBA. I think it makes for good viewing next year. You're going to get a full season next year. You're going to get fans in the stadiums that hopefully, well, obviously they are now, but hopefully as COVID continues, hopefully to go away, and you get more, you'll play the whole season at full capacity. Fans will play more of an impact, which they played an impact definitely this year. I mean, it was great to see the Deer District in full force in Game 6, but to go back to somewhat of a normal season, I think will make this even more fun for the NBA. There's a lot of young stars they can market. I think they learned that throughout this playoffs. Yeah, their ratings weren't great, but they, in a sense, found a way to market newer players in a way. So that was impressive. So congratulations to the Milwaukee Bucks on winning the NBA championship. NBA draft, as I said, is Thursday. I think Cade Cunningham will be the number one pick. I don't really see a lot of huge buzz around the draft outside maybe some trades. We'll probably recap the draft more on the next show. But again, like Golden State, I think is intriguing with their two picks, what they do. Looking more again at the top half of the draft and kind of teams that are around that contending area. And I think, to me, the focus, well, we look at Cunningham and Jalen Green and Evan Mobley and those top guys. Jalen Suggs, I want to see where he goes. Big fan of his game. But it's more, my team I'm looking forward to is, I said, the Warriors. What do they add in the draft if they add anything at all? So let me get into the Olympics. We can talk about some of the actual Olympic sports while we're over here, and I think we'll do that in this segment too before we go to our next segment. We'll start though with Team USA. If you watch this morning, and if you're watching like I did, I had planned to watch the midnight airing. I thought that was live. It's all the USA preliminary games are on Peacock, which is the NBC subscription service. You have to pay to watch them. So it was on at 8 a.m. this morning. So if you're planning on doing that, you can probably like fast forward this a few minutes if you don't want to know the score, but you probably know it by now. France goes on a 16-2 run. At the end of the game, they outscored Team USA 25-11 in the third quarter, and they beat the United States 83-76. The U.S.'s first Olympic loss since 2004, which was the disappointing Olympics in Greece. They lost to Puerto Rico, etc. And the problem you had in this game for Team USA, you had some bad turnovers by Damian Lillard, who only had 11 points, turned over four times. Kevin Durant just 10 points on 4-12 shooting. Bam Adebayo had 10 boards, 12 points, was the leading scorer. Jason Tatum had 9. Drew Holiday led with 18 off the bench. And which is amazing because considering he just came off of winning the finals. Chris Middleton and Devin Booker are back with the team and they just came off playing the finals. And I think there's a couple of things. One, you got to give France credit. This is a talented French team. Evan Fournier had 28. Rudy Gobert, 14 points, 9 boards. There are at least some NBA players on the French squad. Nicolas Batum is on this team. They have Donovan Okolo with 13 points. But to me, you look at this for the Team USA, and it comes off really a disappointing exhibition slate. Yeah, they won a couple of games against Argentina, against Spain, but the Nigeria and Australia losses still stick out. And it's not a runaway for Team USA anymore, and I think there are factors to that. One, a lot of these rosters have NBA players on them that go up against the Durants, the Lillards, the Draymond Greens, the Tatums. They're not afraid to play against these guys. In the past, you were afraid to play against Team USA because you had the superstars. LeBron James isn't here. Steph Curry isn't here. You don't have the Anthony Davises. You don't have the big names of the sport. James Harden obviously is not here either. That plays a factor. I think it coming right after the NBA Finals plays a factor. And it does for a lot of these players. That definitely comes in the equation. And it's like Greg Popovich kind of said post-game, and I think it's kind of an excuse, but I don't think people expected the U.S. to blow out France. But I think you're allowed to expect the U.S. to beat France. I think that's a fair expectation. Your fair expectation is the U.S. should win the gold medal. This is still a very talented team. You've still got a great backcourt, Loader and Durant. Maybe you don't have a lot of, you don't have a big man like Gobert for France, but you've got at least some size with Bam. But it's a disappointment. It's not quite Puerto Rico in 04. I think Puerto Rico in 04 is the downfall, like really the rock bottom low point for Team USA. But it doesn't make you feel good. Don't make you feel good at all. I think the U.S. will be fine. They play Iran and the Czech Republic in their next two games. They should win those games easily, I think. That'll put them at 2-1. And then we'll see what they do in the knockout stage because they struggle with Australia. I still maybe they see France again, Spain. There are some good teams. Like Luka Doncic is playing for Slovenia. You never know. Maybe Luka has a career game in the Olympics. But it's kind of like I saw a quote from a French player, and I forget who gave the quote. It was, they're good as players, but as a team, they got to figure it out. And I think that's true. They've got to figure out how to play together. And that takes time, unfortunately. And the U.S. doesn't exactly have that much time to go together. Remember, a lot of these guys were playing playoff games about a month ago. You can't develop that chemistry as a bunch of other teams probably could have. It's not an excuse. Again, I'm not giving excuses to the U.S. for losing this game, but there are reasons. Is it as embarrassing as the U.S. women's soccer team losing 3-0 to Sweden, although they bounced back Saturday against New Zealand? No, because I think U.S. women kind of talked the big game against Sweden and fell flat on their face. But it's disappointing. And they're gonna the U.S. men's team have a lot of building back that confidence and that trust from people thinking it's going to be an easy cakewalk for them to win the gold. It's not. And I think of the exhibition slate, although I wasn't as worried about it, I don't think, again, you're not panicking they lost to France. It is still disappointing. And they've got to find a way to get this back on track, and we'll see if they do over the next couple of weeks. I've been liking what I've seen from the Olympics so far. Opening ceremonies were great. I enjoyed watching those. We saw in the pool Saturday night in the States, Chase Kalish and Jay Lohenbrandt win gold and silver in the 400-meter IM. That was fun to watch. I love the swimming. Michael Phelps did a good job on the broadcast. The softball team is in the gold medal game against Japan. That should be a lot of fun watching that later this week. Baseball gets underway. I'm looking forward to watching some baseball. I'm glad that's back in the Olympics for sure. Gymnastics is this week, so we'll see what Simone Biles can do. Track and field starts late next week. So far, so good for the Olympics. I will say that much. And Japan, I know, is doing the best they can. We talked about it last week. It's still different watching these sports without fans in the stands, but it's been cool. I think NBC, like I said last week, has done a great job kind of with the viewing parties, seeing like the big parties in Florida, and when the athletes win the medal, they put their family on a Zoom or a Skype, whatever they use, to kind of wish their loved one congratulations. There's a story this week with Shannon Forty. Her dad, Pat, works in the media, so he's there. I saw that on NBC yesterday. It should be a great moment for that family. So, I think the Olympics have been great. We'll see what the women's basketball team does. I think they should be a runaway gold medal team, but we'll see. And we're going to get into it more as the week goes on, but we'll see how the U.S. men respond, because that was, I won't say embarrassing, but I will say disappointing. So we'll take our first break. We'll come back and we'll talk Texas and Oklahoma to the SEC. Boy, the college football realignment just continues to get better and better. You're listening to Kicking with Kior here on Full Press Radio. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Kicking with Kior here on Full Press Radio. I want to remind you, of course, you can check out our live radio lineup every weekday. Here on the network, FPC Radio Live with Ian Glenn and Mike Debate at 8:30 a.m. They get you set for the day that in sports and the day that look back at the day that was. We have the College Credit Hour with Memphis Spence, and we have Dylan and Ross Save Sports in the afternoon. They save sports all the time, but they mostly do it in the afternoon. So be sure to check that out. as your day goes on. Want to get into college football? And as I said this week, well, I said in the past segment, excuse me, college football realignment just always gets better and better. You never know when teams are going to end up where it's like a big game of musical chairs. And the big bombshell this week is the potential of Texas and Oklahoma leaving the Big 12 for the SEC. It's a move that likely will get closer to finalization either this week or next week. We'll see what happens in terms of how soon Texas and Oklahoma go to the SEC. Remember, there is a grant of rights that the Big 12 wants you to follow. So Oklahoma and Texas could have to pay up to $150 million to buy out of the contract. But this is huge for college football. Huge. You talk about potentially going to a 12-team playoff in a couple of years, and to now have Texas and Oklahoma potentially in the SEC. This is big for both of those programs. And look, they're already fine in the Big 12 regardless. But you are now seeing the era of super conferences start to form. Because you look at the SEC, Alabama, Auburn, A&M, Florida, Georgia, LSU, Tennessee, if they can get back on track. And now you got Oklahoma and Texas into the mix. It's insane. It's insane how good this conference is. And I think the SEC, it helps them because, look, they've got the ESPN contract in a couple years once the CBS contract winds down. So when you look at OU and Texas, no more big noon kickoffs. I mean, they'll play at noon sometimes, but you would think they're going to get a lot of big 3:30 or primetime games. It's going to help them. They're going to be able to recruit that they're in the SEC, which I get why Texas A&M would be upset about that. They want to be the only SEC school in the conference. But to bring Texas and Texas A&M back as a rivalry would be so much fun. It reminds you of the Big 12 of old, because the Big 12 of old doesn't exist anymore. And it makes the SEC that much more powerful. I mean, you now bring in Lincoln Riley with Oklahoma, who wins Big 12 every year. And it creates more competitive balance for the SEC. Because, look, Oklahoma's going to dominate Big 12 every year. It's honestly become boring to watch Big 12 football. I know Iowa State has made some nice runs, and Baylor's made some nice runs, and Oklahoma State's been decent. Kansas State's been decent in some years when they had Bill Snyder as coach. But you knew kind of going to the Big 12, you're either picking Oklahoma or you're picking Texas more often than not. And Texas has been down in recent years. We'll see if they bounce back with Steve Sarkisian as coach. The question is now, what do you do with the Big 12? And I bring this up, and you'll hear my question to Josh Neighbors in a little bit. Is it better for them to expand and add teams like BYU, Boise State, Houston, Cincinnati to try to save the conference? Or is it just inevitable that they're going to get picked apart? There was a report this week that Kansas wanted to talk to the Big Ten, which for basketball would be huge. You're now adding Bill Self, essentially playing Tom Izzo every year in conference twice. So from a basketball standpoint, Kansas going to the Big Ten would make that make the Big Ten the best conference in college basketball. You're looking at maybe Heather Dinich, I saw on ESPN Sunday morning, was talking about maybe West Virginia wants to go to the ACC. Now, that would be good because you now continue to build that coastline, but does the ACC want West Virginia? It would kind of also bring back the Big East of old with Miami and Virginia Tech, and now you have West Virginia and Boston College. Kind of like the old Big East football conference in a way, but and Pitt and Syracuse, so you kind of throw those in there too. Super conferences are going to be the way the sport goes. Because if you have a 12-team playoff, how much is non-conference schedule really going to matter? How much is scheduling that marquee game like an Oregon-Ohio State or Georgia-Clemson or Michigan-Washington, how much is that going to really matter when you can play 9-10 conference games and have super leagues where you're going to constantly have games to improve your resume? It's not. It's a much better format than what the sport is now, where you can easily predict 3 of the 4 college football playoff teams and now everybody's playing for one spot. Now, the team it could hurt is Notre Dame. Where I think Notre Dame would then maybe have to say, look, we kind of have to join the ACC, or we're going to get left out. So maybe pressuring Notre Dame to go to the ACC full-time helps that. What it speaks trouble to, I think, is the Pac-12 is in trouble. Now, the Pac-12 could easily go pick these Big 12 schools apart and add a couple of them in there. Add an Oklahoma State, add Texas Tech, etc. Does the Big 10 try to add more than just Kansas? Although I think Kansas is more the play for the Big 10 because you get the Kansas City market, which is huge. And we know they love to add those big-time markets. Why do you think they added Maryland and Rutgers? Well, especially, why do you think they added Rutgers? They want the New York market in the Big Ten. But looking at this, the wheels of realignment just never stop. We thought it stopped a long time ago, when it looked like everything had kind of settled down, and Nebraska had left for the Big Ten, Colorado left for the Pac-12. You've had, of course, Syracuse and Pitt leave for the ACC. You had Texas A&M, Missouri go to the SEC, and it kind of looked, okay, things kind of leveled off. But that's when you know, when things start to get quiet in realignment land, that's when things tend to pick up a little bit. And it gets really, really interesting. Because when the music stops, who's left without a chair? Because there's always going to be somebody left without a chair. Now, you could form your own chairs, like maybe you see BYU, Boise State, and some of these conferences get, these mid-major schools or non-power fives get together and create their own conference. That'd be pretty cool. Because if a group of five is going to get in, why not create a big group of five conference? I mean, you could make that happen. But it's great for the SEC. I think it's great. You see Kevin Warren, the commissioner of the Big Ten, talk about this week. Potentially having a Big Ten championship at MetLife in future years, I think is going to be great for the sport. Kind of, let's say you get a Ohio State. I'm trying to think who would they looking at the trying to like. Let's say an Ohio State Wisconsin Big Ten championship at MetLife. I think people would go watch. And having the Big Ten in New York only makes it better. But this hurts the Big 12, which was once a really proud conference. I remember as a kid watching like Nebraska play Oklahoma, watching Colorado play against Texas in Pac-12 in Big 12 championships. Big 12 is not what it once was. It's not a horrible league, but there's a reason why sometimes they don't get a team in the playoff. There's no balance in terms of football. Now, basketball, Kansas is dominated, although Baylor just came off winning the national championship. So there are still good basketball teams. Like, look at if Texas goes to the SEC. And you get a Chris Beard against John Calipari maybe in future years. Potentially Texas playing Tennessee with Rick Barnes at Tennessee. Oklahoma with Porter Moser now and there. Without, I think Oklahoma is usually competitive in basketball in Big 12. You get another competitive basketball school in the SEC. The competition only gets better for that conference. And there's a reason why the SEC is the best conference in college football. And college sports, I don't think so, because again, I think, as I said, the Big Ten's best in college basketball. But the SEC for football, it's not even close. So coming up next, you'll hear my conversation with Josh Neighbors from Locked On Big 12 and Locked On Nationals. We will talk Max Scherzer at some point, so be sure to keep an eye out for that. And we'll say after that segment, we will talk a little bit of hockey and a little bit of baseball. Coming up on the we'll talk baseball and then we'll talk hockey coming up on Kicking with Keyword here on Full Press Radio. We will be right back. College football could be in the midst of another shakeup as the reports are out this week that Texas and Oklahoma could still move from the Big 12 to the SEC. And yes, I never thought I would say that, but that's where we are. And joining us to talk about what it could mean for the Big 12, what it means for Texas and Oklahoma. You can find him as the host of Locked On Big 12 and the host of Locked On Nationals on the Locked On Podcast Network. Josh Neighbors is here. Josh, how are you doing today?
I wish you could say I'm doing well. I'm not, because the Big 12 right now has consumed my life, which is fine, but it's been a negative way. So I'm doing well personally, but it's always upsetting when you hear some news like we've got right now.
Is this news that came out this week that surprising to you?
I think it's the timing is surprising. This was something that I think we all thought was going to come, the expansion of conferences, kind of the super conferences, as the playoff expands. I think so too do these bigger conferences and the television contracts get really big. The Big Ten's got the biggest. The SEC has the second biggest, and I'm sure with these additions, it might become the biggest next time the contract comes up. So it's not surprising in the sense of like this was inevitable, but the timing is shocking, absolutely shocking. Nobody saw this coming, especially during SEC media days, SEC kickoff as they call it now. But for this news to drop then, you know, I was just actually working a show this morning for SiriusXM. Chris Blank, who works for XM and also worked for the Oklahoma Sooners radio network. He is the voice of the women's basketball team as well as Oklahoma softball. And he said it's the most shocking news they've had, maybe even more shocking since Bob Stoops retired, which kind of caught them by surprise at Oklahoma. So everybody's shocked at the timing of it, not necessarily the fact that it's happening. But the timing is what makes it all feel kind of like a, you know, complete surprise for everybody.
We know that they've said that by 2025, they would like to be out. But is this something you would think Texas and Oklahoma would ideally try to know? I know it would be like $75+ million if both sides to leave. Is this something, is the last year you think they're both going to be in the Big 12?
Yeah, a couple things on this. So one, you know, it's weird. It's tough to think that they'd stay till 2025 after stabbing the conference in the back, right? It just kind of, it seems like, you know, it's like a breakup when you break up with somebody, you know, it's not like, hey, you know, let's do it in 3 months, you know, let's do it in a year, right? When you break up with somebody, like we're breaking up. And that's the weird part about this, is that now a couple things, you know, I was, I've been doing some reading on this and, you know, you can negotiate a buyout of a contract. Contracts can always be ripped up for new contracts. It's why players demand more money. It's why, you know, entities all the time reshape stuff. You negotiate extensions, whatever it is. So they could negotiate an out of the contract they have. And I think it's possible because they might make up that money in the long term with the SEC. But we'll have to see what happens. The other piece of this too, which shouldn't be too much of a problem, is the Longhorn Network. Still has a lot left on that contract. But ESPN does have the rights to Southeastern Conference and the Longhorn Network. So I'm sure that the SEC and Texas and the Longhorn Network, they would all come to an agreement about how to maybe close the book on Longhorn Network and you know, make that transition feasible financially for everybody involved. So I don't see it happening this – obviously it's not happening now because schedules are out and everybody's going to play. So this year it's going to be – we're going to have a full Big 12, 10 teams. I would say maybe when playoff expansion – occurs, that's probably the best timeline. It's kind of the consensus right now is, hey, just line it up with that. But you know, maybe give the Oklahoma Texas a year to kind of get themselves ready to go. So I would say it's going to happen before 2023. It would be my hunch. My hunch is that be like before the 2023 football season starts. So maybe not this season or next season, but the following season, we'd have something concrete. We'd be, you know, at the point where you know, that they figure it out and SEC and Oklahoma and Texas will move on.
So from the Big 12 standpoint, Josh, is it easier for them to expand by adding different schools, or is it just inevitable that these other conferences, like maybe the Pac-12 or the ACC, or even we heard Kansas with meeting with the Big 10, is it expansion or disintegration basically?
Disintegration, I think, is the more likely way. Obviously, people will try to save the conference, and there's reports that that the Big 12 will try to offer Texas and Oklahoma more money to stay. So, you know, I think that ship maybe has sailed. Sure, they'll listen to the offer, maybe out of courtesy, but I think that ship has probably sailed at this point. Look, I think it makes more sense to break up because that's eventually how it's going to work anyway. I don't think you gain a lot by adding Houston and adding SMU. Now, if you were able to add like a BYU, a Boise State, a Houston, and you ended up adding a you know, an SMU, sure, maybe you could possibly make that work. We added four teams, went to back to 12 again. Maybe you can try to go for a Cincinnati if possible somewhere in there. But to me, it makes just more sense. Like Iowa State and Kansas end up going to the Big Ten. West Virginia goes to the ACC, Oklahoma State and couples go to the Pac-12. Now, some people might get left out, and we'll see what happens to the Group of Five. Maybe the Group of Five kind of joins together the best teams do to create the best possible conference there. So, you know, and you add in Kansas State to the world, and you add in, whoever else is New Texas Tech, whoever else is left over afterwards. But I think disintegration is more likely, which is really sad to say, but I think that's more likely that four bigger conferences, power four almost, if you will, as opposed to a, five separate conferences again.
going back to the Big 12 bowl, I know Texas A&M has kind of been like the only, outside of Missouri, the public school that's like, yeah, we don't really want Texas to be there, but we can't say publicly we don't want them, but we don't want them. Is the Texas-Texas A&M rivalry good for college football to potentially bring that back, or is it just more A&M is just mad they're the only Texas school in the SEC and they want that to change?
Well, the issue for Texas A&M, for Arkansas, and for Missouri, those three teams in particular, is that this hurts them the most, and LSU to some extent too. This hurts them the most because they are the three teams that really do hit Texas hard. Just think about it geographically. Like, you know, I actually went to Mizzou. A lot of kids from Dallas there. And you'll see a lot of kids from the Missouri team, you know, on from Texas and Arkansas as well. Arkansas, you know, Jerry Jones owns the Cowboys. And he's an Arkansas guy. He loves it when his Razorbacks play A&M every single – whenever they can. And Jerry World, right? That's a game that he likes seeing. So, obviously, it's huge for recruiting and A&M too. The advantage those three teams have right now is, hey – we're in the, you know, if you're recruiting against Texas and OU, we're in the SEC, they're not. Come play in the Southeastern Conference. Eli Drinkwitz, the head coach at Mizzou, even said as much this week at SEC Media Days. He said that, hey, I texted the guy. Well, actually, told Ben Fredrickson, but admitted that he texted the guys recruiting. He was recruiting and said, look, they all want to join us. You should come play for us because, look, they all want to join the SEC. Come play with us. We're already here. We already know what we're doing in this conference. So it's going to hurt them. They've got to kind of accelerate whatever processes they have now to try to get their foothold in the SEC and try to beat those other teams like OU and Texas. But for A&M, Ross Bjork, who actually we had on the radio show this morning, was trying to walk back what he said, but they're clearly upset. They felt like they were either A, kept in the dark, or B, they knew about it kind of, but this process once again got accelerated a lot faster than they thought it would. And so – for them, they value the fact that they're the only Texas team, but they have to watch how much hand-wringing they do because they look like a bit of whiners and complainers at a certain point. You know, they keep pouting over and over again. Tom Luganbill, who I was working with this morning, floated the idea that maybe they just say, hey, look, bring it on. Because if you think about football right now, like, Texas is nowhere near as good as A&M. A&M was almost a playoff team last year. A lot of people thought they should have been. I didn't. But, Jimbo's built a really great program there, and they're, if it's basketball, they're big brother right now. They really are big brother compared to Texas A&M. So I think A&M should lean into that and should really try to basically say, hey, look, we're the Texas team in this conference. It's supposed to be like, no. We want to be the only team. When Texas comes, you know, greet them with a couple of thumpings and say, hey, we're no longer little brother. Welcome to the conference. We are the Texas team here.
Yeah, it just seems odd they would embrace playing Alabama but wouldn't embrace playing Texas when you.
Yeah, well, in theory that makes sense, but when you think about like the recruiting part of it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is their advantage. We are the SEC Texas team, and look at where they are, and look at where we are. Now that's what they get. They have that right now, but for how long, right? And you know, Steve Sarkisian is going to do a great. I think he's going to do a really good job recruiting, especially, and we'll see if he gets time, what they can build. But, you know, I think the excuses for Texas are about to go out the window. Because the Big 12 was an easy conference, and they still can win it. But now it's like, all right, you're an SEC team, so you've got that chip. The visibility is the highest. You are in the toughest conference. You are a massive brand. Everybody wants you, you know what I mean? So this is your chance to get all the best players and actually make something happen. So we'll see what happens with Texas success-wise. But I think A&M needs to capitalize off their unique position of being better than right now, especially in football.
Could the Big 12, Josh, have been more ahead of the game on this? I'm not talking losing Nebraska and Colorado in the past, but I'm saying, like, having now the Fox contract where they play at noon, so many noon games are now Oklahoma and Texas could maybe go to the SEC or ESPN and it won't be on so many noon time slots. And then also the lack of competitive balance. I mean, every year we see Oklahoma win the Big 12 in football, and mm-hmm. I know Iowa State's emerged and Baylor's emerged in recent years, Oklahoma State for – couple of years here or there, but there's just no consistent rival to those two schools, and maybe they feel more challenges in the SEC than opposed to a Big 12 where they could lose a game or two early like Oklahoma did last year and just run through the rest of the schedule.
Yeah, I mean, the competition part is a great aspect. We've talked about this a lot, but look, for Oklahoma, the big key for them is if they beat Oklahoma, if they beat Kansas State, they're in the playoff every single year, right? I mean, that's kind of the deal. If they beat Kansas State last year, they're in the playoff, no doubt, even with their one loss to Iowa State. You know, if for them also, in addition to that, like other factors, you talk about the competition part of it, and it kind of cuts two ways, right? At some point, you're going to play at the highest competition, but also right now, the competition is more conducive than a 12-team playoff. But once again, if you go to the SEC, the 12-team playoff, you're going to get the benefit of the doubt like those teams always do. They might send six in a 16-team SEC. Six to 12 teams could be Southeastern Conference teams, or five to 12, whatever it is, could be SEC teams at some point in time. So I think for Texas, that's where the competition part, where it's going to be tough because – look, you could argue right now, if Texas was in the SEC West, where are they? Are they a better program at this moment than Alabama? No. Are they better than LSU? No. Are they better than Auburn? No. Are they better than A&M? No. Ole Miss, I would take this year's Ole Miss team of Texas in a heartbeat. Mississippi State, that's probably the only team right now in the SEC West that they're a better program than right now in the East, Georgia, and Florida. If they played Missouri this year, I'm not sure how that game would go. It could go either way. If they played Kentucky, how'd that game go? It could go either way. So really you're looking at a situation where, they would not be one of the best eight teams in that conference. Probably not. So they're the ones who have to do a lot more work. And if you add an OU, it's another team that's going to be ahead of them. Could the conference have done more? I've heard people criticizing Bob Bowlesby. Sure, he should probably know that this is coming. And yes, maybe the Big 12 should have been a bit more proactive in expanding their conference, but the SEC is just a vacuum was eventually going to suck up all the space. It's kind of how it works. And the Big 12 being at only 10 teams was at a disadvantage compared to ACC, which got 14 basically, and 15 if you count Notre Dame and every other sport. The Big 10's at 14. The Pac-12 is at 14. So the Big 10 was kind of the natural choice. Big 12 rather was a natural choice with those two brands like OU and Texas to be the one that's picked apart as opposed to the one that's adding on. Now, there had been talk before about them adding Arizona State and Arizona. So, from the actual expansion part of it, maybe they could have been more proactive, but from the competition part of it, they were always kind of the logical team to pick off because Texas to the Big Ten and Texas to the SEC, two biggest money contracts, more money available for them, in the next contract when it gets negotiated. So it's kind of felt like it was inevitable. And I think a lot of us are kind of kicking ourselves for not seeing the fact that it's like, hey, let's just do it now, much like the playoff expansion.
So let's say the Big 12 decided not to disintegrate. And let's hypothetically say they kept everybody minus Texas and Oklahoma. With both of those schools leaving, who would it benefit? Is it Iowa State as long as Matt Campbell is there? Is it Oklahoma State because with name, image, and likeness, they got the money, they can kind of afford to pay guys? Is it Texas Tech? Who would benefit more hypothetically if everything stayed the same, you just lost Texas and Oklahoma?
Well, it's a great question because, the fun thing about the Big 12 is, and I talk about this all the time, the last like 15 years, think about the teams that have made a push for a Big 12 championship, Kansas State, TCU, Baylor, Iowa State, Texas. And I know you asked about them, but they're leaving. Baylor, like all these schools have been in the Big 12 championship game in the last 10 to 15 years. And it's all because, how competitive the conference is and how kind of these schools go in cycles of how good they are. So that's a problem because there's no kind of obvious answer for domination, who would be the dominant team. I will say this, if Matt Campbell stayed at Iowa State, that's your answer. But I don't know, like especially with this breaking up, the best move now for – If Iowa State is either A, get in the Big Ten or try to find some other home. But for Matt Campbell, if they're left and they're not in a power conference, this is all said and done for him. I'm taking my talents to the next level, right? That's kind of the next logical move. Why would you stay in the Big Eight or whatever becomes the AAC when you're like, look, my talents are better used elsewhere as opposed to Ames, Iowa? Because right now there are roadblocks to clear, right? There is the fact that they're a top team. They've got Oklahoma, who they think they can try to chase down and beat and get into a playoff. Because right now they've already won a New Year's Six Bowl. They already made it last year. They want to be on the up and up. They don't want to be in the middle because of where that program is currently on a rocket ship right now. And they don't want to get detached to the rocket. And I feel like there's a chance they could if they're left as an 8-team conference.
Taking the expansion and the whole realignment aside, we had Big 12 Media Days recently. What was your takeaway from those media days and what stood out to you the most?
I'm not a huge – I don't like media days to me. I think they are I think they're annoying. I think the fact that we only had three quarterbacks or whatever, not many quarterbacks if you have any, were there this year. No Spencer Rattler. was kind of annoying. I know Jeremiah Hall, fullback from Oklahoma, is fun, good interview. Everybody loves him. Lincoln Riley, when asked about why Spencer Rattler wasn't there, said, you know, he's a redshirt sophomore. But, like, Spencer Rattler is kind of almost the face of college football this year. He is the kind of consensus right now. Not consensus, but he's the thought to be number one pick. Use a track record. Lincoln Riley has placed three quarterbacks, his last three. Two of them won Heismans. One of them came in second. All three of them were first-round picks. Two of them were number one picks. And all three of them were starting quarterbacks last year in the NFL. The trajectory says that this will probably be his fourth. He's going to be a quarterback in the NFL. He's going to be a first-round pick no matter what next year. And normal path says he'll probably be number one. He'll probably be in the Heisman talk. We'll see. But it projects pretty well for him. That guy should be there. So I think the fact he wasn't there just kind of shows you that this is just talking season. It's kind of the unofficial start to the year. And also Mike Gundy cut his mullet. So there's that too.
So last one for you, Josh. I know people talk about the pod system with the 16 team potential SEC and going to this pod format. What do you make of it? And what would be the more intriguing pod if super conferences went that route?
Well, if you're going to go pods, to me, the logical answer for pods would be the four Big 12 schools. So I would do Oklahoma, Texas, A&M, and Missouri for that one. Then kind of your middle southeast area. So Arkansas, LSU would be in there. You can chuck Tennessee, I guess, in there with Vanderbilt if you kind of wanted to do that centralized one. You could do your Florida one where it's kind of more towards the south, Florida, Georgia, Alabama and Auburn, and then you kind of move up and do, let's see, I'm trying to think about who I'm missing. It could depend. You could group together the Ole Misses and the Mississippi States with Alabama and Auburn. You could do the East Coast line where you do Florida, you know, you do South Carolina. I mean, there's a lot of ways, you know, Georgia, there's a lot of ways they could go about this. To me, it's weird because the pod system would just basically be like, look, you're playing these four teams every year, but I think the best way to do it is, like, make sure you're going to play everybody. You get as many experiences as possible. Aaron Murray talked about it the other day. He said that as a quarterback in 4 years starting at Oklahoma, Georgia rather, he never went to Tuscaloosa, never got that opportunity. I think we got to make sure we do that. Whatever the scheduling is, make sure everybody gets to have some fresh matchups and go everywhere to play everybody.
Yeah, I think if you had everybody play everybody, the downside for the other conferences, you're not going to get a chance to play the SEC schools and kind of boost your playoff resume. I know in a 12-team playoff, it would be relevant that you would think the conference champs get in and things. But if you're trying to get in as an at-large and you can't play an SEC team because they're all playing each other, it kind of hurts the rest of college football and kind of puts us somewhat not back to where we are now where it's predictable, but it's really, if I can't play an SEC team, I can't have as good a resume as the SEC team.
Yeah, you're going to get you're going to get less non-conference games, mostly because here's the deal. With this expansion, I mean, the SEC should go to 9 conference games, right? It's 16 teams. It's logical to go to 9. Some conferences, like the Big Ten, have already gone to 9. If you factor that in and you want to keep natural rivalries, so, Clemson plays South Carolina every single year, stuff like that. Florida plays Florida State. You're now down to 2. So what I would do really is so people don't like the FCS games. I like it when teams play FCS teams or smaller programs in their state. So if LSU plays Southeast Louisiana, right, Northwestern State, I'm okay with that because that's supporting a program because those are check games. That supports another program in your state. So I'm fine with that. So if we cross that off the list, there's 2 of them. So, you know, natural rival a lot of times for some of those schools, and then also, you know, Georgia Tech, stuff like that. So that kind of crosses one off right there. And then there's one extra spot. So I think that there's a chance that, that we might not see these big non-conference games anymore because just the scheduling may not work. But at the same time, you know, your margin of error grows a little bit with the 12-team playoff. So, you know, because everybody's talking about this Georgia-Clemson game, it's an awesome game, but a lot of people think, hey, how much does it matter? Because both these teams can definitely handle a loss and still make it all the way to the championship. Excuse me, maybe in some cases they can handle 2 losses. So I think that's a big part of this is what is that non-conference scheduling look like? Does everybody kind of go into their own corner, right? The Pac-12 teams, you know, are only playing the Boise's, right, the BYU's, The teams like that that are kind of in those Colorado states, right? The teams that are in the Mountain West area, those are the only teams you're going to end up playing in non-conference. Or will you take the risk and Oregon's going to play Ohio State? You know, is Michigan going to play Florida State? Stuff like that. So it's a big aspect of it. But I would say this kind of stuff discourages it because the schedules are going to get harder for all of these teams with more conference games.
Josh, you're a man of many hosting abilities, so tell listeners out there what other stuff you host or are part of and how they can follow you and any work that you do on Twitter.
Yes, thank you. So you can find me on Twitter at @JoshNeighbors_. I am the host of the Locked On Nationals podcast. I host the Locked On Nationals podcast. That is it's basically every single day right now. Football's going to go to every single day too. The Nationals might sell, so we want to hear about that, or Max Scherzer could land, all those things. That'll be coming up. Too. So you've got that going on, and then you can follow that at @LO_Nationals. You can follow the Big 12 one at @LO Big 12. A lot going on right now. I'm a very busy person, but I really enjoyed talking to you. So thank you for having me on, Ricky.
Very quickly, Max Scherzer, where does he go and where do you want him to go?
Wherever has the best prospects that can send us, not the Yankees though. They don't have any prospects. I would prefer him go to a place like, if San Diego wants to get in on this and send us some prospects, the Nationals. I'm actually, full disclosure, I'm a Mets fan, but I do the Nats podcast. So it's better when the Nationals are good, just for business as a whole. But yeah, Tampa maybe makes sense because they've got some guys they can handle and they don't mind paying the rest of the contract out. So I would guess it's going to be one of the bigger money teams.
I'd say for me, in a perfect world, I don't know if they have the prospect capital, San Francisco, because if the Giants got him, he basically is their new Bumgarner and –
I'm not even sure the Giants need him. I don't even know that they've been so surprising and so good this year. But yeah, that might be a great fit for him.
I think for them, because I was thinking about this, if in a best of five, you have to play the Dodgers or the Padres and your best option is Gausman. I mean, are they very comfortable going with Dave Scofani and Alex Wood? And they might be, but I feel like.
No, yeah, you're right. Pitching them on Tuesday night against Arizona is one thing. Pitching them in a playoff game against the Dodgers is another, right? They're two totally different things.
So be sure to check Josh's workout throughout the week during the trade deadline and throughout the college football and college sports seasons with the Big 12 and all the other great things he's a part of. Josh, thanks for hopping on. We'll do this again soon. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, man, of course. Anytime.
Special thanks to Josh Neighbors from Locked On Big 12 and Locked On Nationals for hopping on the show, giving us some insight on what the Big 12 is facing right now. Want to get into the world of baseball. Trade deadline is Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern, and there are so many interesting storylines involved with that. There's not really the consensus superstar, although you could argue one might become available due to a team's recent struggles. This came this morning. John Heyman from LB Network said, talk about Max Scherzer, who did not make his start Saturday night due to a triceps injury. But Scherzer told the media after Saturday's game he's likely not going to go in the IL. He just wanted to not pitch and make it more serious. The Nats are 8 games under 500 coming into Sunday. They're not going to make the playoffs. They're going to sell. And Heyman tweeted, the likelihood of a Scherzer deal is increasing. Any trade would need to be contingent on medicals and his 10-5 veto rights. Obviously, Scherzer can approve where he wants to go. Adding Max Scherzer to any contending team makes them a more of a perennial favorite to win a pennant. And when you're the Nationals, you have to make this deal. You have to because you have one of the worst farm systems in baseball. You have to because he's your best trade chip. You're not going to trade Juan Soto. He's a franchise player. Even though Trey Turner has a year left on his deal, you're not going to trade Trey Turner. You're going to look to extend him if you can. You're probably not bringing back Max Scherzer next year, although you could maybe try to see if you have good faith and try to bring him back. Scherzer, I'm sure, has loved pitching in D.C. The Nationals gave him a big lucrative contract. He's really been one of the only pitchers who has lived up to the $210 million he got 7 years ago. When I was at District on Deck covering the Nationals for Fansided, my first year was when Max Scherzer signed that contract. And he is so much fun to watch, and he would make a difference on any contender. That's why you have to move him. I don't think Mike Rizzo has a choice. I think it's one of those things where you go to Max and you say, where do you want to go? Where do you want to go and how it can help best suit us to getting a best return back? And there are a few places I think he can go that make an impact. One is the Astros. you look at Houston right now, I mean, Zach Greinke, Framber Valdez, Lance McCullers. I mean, if Houston added Scherzer into that mix, with a team that's already 21 games over 500 without Alex Bregman, the Astros would look like the favorite in the American League again. They might be right now. I think it's between them, the White Sox, and the Red Sox. So I'll argue Tampa got better. But Houston is definitely in the conversation. I think Scherzer fits for them. Tampa Bay. Now, do the Rays want to take on that money? Tampa's made some good moves. Adding Nelson Cruz from the Twins helps their offense. They did, though, trade Rich Hill to the Mets for a pitcher who's likely not going to pitch this season in Tommy Hunter, and a fourth-round catcher from last year for the Mets who's in Double-A. So basically, they dumped Rich Hill's salary, which Hill pitched great to begin the year. He had struggled the last few starts. I think Hill fits the Mets, though, because they desperately needed a starter now because they play five games in the next 4 days against Atlanta. But for Tampa, you could add Scherzer or you could add Charlie Morton, bring him back if Atlanta decides to sell. So Tampa's in the market for a starting pitcher. Do the Red Sox make a run at Scherzer? I think he would make sense there. Does Chaim Bloom want to give up some of those top prospects? From a system that's not at the top of the sport, it's not the best fit for Washington, but Scherzer in Boston with Eduardo Rodriguez and Nate Eovaldi and Chris Sale coming back, that would be really interesting. So Boston could be a good fit. In the National League, I'm looking at the NL West. I don't think – I would say Milwaukee, but they've already got Woodruff, Burns, and Peralta. I don't think they're going to spend the money to get Scherzer. So think of those three teams. The Dodgers, we don't know when and if Trevor Bauer is going to pitch because he's still on the administrative leave. Clayton Kershaw is battling injury. And you might have to have Walker Buehler can't – I mean, you could probably line it up if you don't win the division to pitch Walker Buehler in that one-game playoff, but – Scherzer would help that team. San Diego, that sells a lot of good young prospects. C.J. Abrams, Mackenzie Gore, the Padres. But to me, this is a team I'm looking at. And I said this, you heard this at the end of the interview with Josh. I think it's the Giants. The Giants would be the great fit for him because I look at San Francisco right now. They've got a really good rotation. Kevin Gausman, outside of his last couple starts, has pitched like a Cy Young contender this season. Alex Wood has been good for them. They've found different ways to be competitive. They've got the team. They've got the good lineup. But this is where I think the Giants and Farhan Zaidi have to look at this. Is my team good enough to win a World Series? It might be harsh to say, but again, think about it. If they win the division, the best of five would be against either LA or San Diego. Are you comfortable with Johnny, with Cosman, Wood, Cueto, and Dave Sclafani? Not in that particular order, but those four guys. I'm not so sure. So if you went out and added Max Scherzer and had at least a 1-2 of Scherzer and Cosman, Alex Wood in a game three, Cueto or Dave Sclafani in a game four. Probably Dave Sclafani leads the team and wins right now with 10. It only makes you better. The Giants don't have, again, a great farm system. Would they give the Nationals a Joey Bart in that kind of trade? The Nationals don't really have that franchise catcher right now. They could probably use that. So to me, I look at San Francisco, and I think that's the most entertaining fit. I don't think it's the best prospect fit. The best prospect fit San Diego. But San Francisco would be really fun to see. In terms of possible trades this week, when you look at the Pirates, I think as a team I'm going to look to, Tyler Anderson's a starter that could get moved. What do they do with Adam Frazier and Brian Reynolds? Two of their best position players, do they move them? But let me give you a couple teams I'm watching this week. We talked about the three teams in the West, so I won't bring that up again. Seattle, who has done pretty well so far in their weekend series against the A's. They're seven games out in the West, but they're 2.5 back for the A's in the wild card. They've got a good rotation with Logan Gilbert, Marco Gonzalez. Chris Flexen's had a nice bounce back year. Coming over from the KBO, he's been really good. But Seattle's offense is bad. I mean, if you're Jerry DePoto, who's been really aggressive when trying to sell, do they do it when they're buying and be aggressive and add a bat? Because Seattle needs a bat. So I think that would be a good trade. I think that would make sense for them. What does Cleveland do? Right now, they're six back in the Central. They're at 500 as of today. Does Jose Ramirez get moved? I'm not so sure, but against the Indians, you can't rule that out because Shane Bieber's not coming back anytime soon. And without Shane Bieber, the Indians are not a contending team. Keep that in mind. I think the two teams AL East that are intriguing are the Blue Jays going back to Toronto. Do they capitalize off that and try to be aggressive making moves? And what do the Yankees do? Do the Yankees decide? I think they're going to buy. I mean, I don't think the Yankees are dead, but they haven't exactly played great in this Red Sox series this weekend. What do they look to add? Do they just buy for 2022, which I think would be a mistake? Because they don't really have this roster is pretty much the same next year. Their only free agent is Corey Kluber. The Yankees are kind of stuck in the baseball equivalent of the NBA's no man's land. And if Brian Cashman doesn't make a move, it would be 3 years in a row where he doesn't make a significant trade deadline move. And I think people would shine the spotlight on him on there. So the Yankees are under the spotlight maybe for what they don't do as opposed to what they do. So that's big for them. I would like to see Oakland make a move. Maybe they go after Trevor Story, but being 4.5 back at the Astros, I think they could use another significant piece. In the National League, I look at the Mets. I love the Rich Hill move. As I said, it's a low-risk move. They do need, I think, another pitcher. I don't think they'll be able to get Jose Berríos, but they could add another mid-rotation starter just for depth. They could look to add a Chris Bryant, and we'll get into the Cubs in a little bit. But that could be a move, maybe help at third base. What do Atlanta and Philly do? Can they add a significant piece being game under 500 as of Sunday? In the Central, you have the Cubs. I think the Cubs are the biggest story here. Because where does Craig Kimbrell go? Where does Chris Bryant go? You know those two are likely getting traded. Do they trade Anthony Rizzo? Or do they try to extend him, or do they try to extend Javi Baez? The Cubs are in that... They're the seller everybody wants to trade with. It's now about can the Cubs and Jed Hoyer get a good asking price back. Again, I'm not so sure with that either, but I think they'll be able to get a decent haul in return. So let me give you the updated standings, and I'll give you my games to watch for this week. Red Sox and Rays are tied at 60-39. Yankees are 8 back. Blue Jays 8.5 back, and then you got the Orioles. In the Central, White Sox, 9 ahead of the Indians. 6 back in the wild card, I meant to say, is what Cleveland is. So that further makes them look out. Detroit's played a lot better. I know they struggled with Kansas City this week, but they have been one of the better teams in the second half. 6 games under 500, Royals and Twins following up in that division. In the West, the Astros, 4.5 up on Oakland, 7 up on Seattle. Angels and then the Rangers. Rangers have lost 11 in a row, by the way. In the National League, Mets, 4 up on Atlanta and Philly. That'll change by the end of the day because the Braves and Phillies play each other. And Atlanta, we say heads to Citi Field probably for their season on the line in that series. Nationals are 7 back. The Marlins, 11 back. We'll see what they decide to do because they've got some good young pitching. Brewers, 6.5 up on the Reds. Reds are actually closer to the second wild card than the Central. So Cincinnati might be another team we need to look at. Do they sell or do they buy? Because the Reds are another intriguing team. Castillo's starting to pitch better. And their offense has some good pieces on it. Cardinals are 9 back. Cubs are 10 back. They got the Pirates. Then the West, Giants, 2 up on the Dodgers. 4.5 up on the Padres. Then you got Colorado and Arizona. In the wild card, if the season ended today, it would be the Rays or the Red Sox. So I guess they would play a one game to decide it. And then the loser would host Oakland. Seattle's 2.5 back. Yankees 3.5 back. Toronto's 4. Cleveland is 6. Angels 6.5. And then in the National League, the Dodgers would host San Diego. The Reds are 5.5 back. Atlanta is 8 back. Philly is 8 back. St. Louis is 8 back. Cubs are 9 back. Again, Cubs I think are sellers, but I think the cut line is probably Atlanta and Philadelphia, so you have to put St. Louis in there. They're both a game under 500. So let me give you these what to watch this week. I mentioned Braves-Mets, 5 games in 4 days in Citi Field, season on the line for Atlanta. Season's on the line for Philadelphia, hosting Washington to begin the week. Blue Jays, who had a rough series in Buffalo, head to Fenway to take on the Red Sox this time. Can Toronto bounce back? Houston at Seattle. Big week for the Mariners. They just finished, they're going to finish playing a series with the A's. Now they host Houston. So Seattle has a chance to gain some ground in that division if they have a good week. Dodgers at Giants. Begin a series this week in San Francisco. We just saw them play in LA. Dodgers have bullpen issues. Kenley Jansen's been struggling as the closer. Giants won some big games out in Los Angeles. Took 3 out of 4. Can the Giants keep it going at home? But they've definitely made some statements. Cardinals and Indians, I think, is an interesting series. And then the Yankees at Tampa Bay. It sounds like Aaron Judge will be back coming off of COVID for the Yankees. Gio Urshela just came back on Sunday. But the Yankees definitely could use Aaron Judge. I think the Yankees need an outfielder. If you asked me, the only move I would want the Yankees to make as of right now is Starling Marte. I don't think Joey Gallo is available, and I don't think you should pay the asking price for him. I think the Yankees could use an outfielder on a rental that is a good veteran, just a guy that can play. And Marte has had some experience on winning teams. They're with the Pirates, and they've been to the playoffs when he was there. With Miami last year, got to the playoffs. They're with Arizona. I kind of look at them like when the Yankees got McCutchen, and you don't have to give up as much of your farm system. So I think and the Marlins know the Yankees system very well. So I think that's a match that you could see happen over the next week. And then as the weekend gets closer, the series to watch there, Boston at Tampa for first place in the AL East. You have Giancarlo Stanton's return to Miami. Maybe he plays the outfield with the Yankees and the Marlins. Brewers at the Braves. Reds at the Mets. Cleveland at the White Sox. Maybe Cleveland's last stand if they can somehow have a good start to the week. And how about a potential World Series preview in San Francisco? Astros at Giants. That should be a lot of fun for that matchup. Want to quickly get into hockey because we're going to talk with our guest in a little bit. Seattle Kraken had their expansion draft. I don't really like that not the league, but some reporters were leaking out the picks. Again, we're in 2021. It's social media. You're going to see it. I know the league wasn't too happy about it because they planned this big ESPN special. And they wanted the picks to kind of be a surprise. But look, some things are just out of your control. You can't help that. But I like that the Kraken kind of got experience on defense. They need to still add some goal scorers, but they're under the salary cap. They weren't going to make the same trades that Vegas was able to make because Vegas was able to get to the Stanley Cup final their first year. I think teams learned their lesson from that. Don't exactly help the expansion team get that good. But some interesting talent on the Kraken. They had a top 2 pick in this draft, took Matthew Beniers from Michigan after the Sabres took defenseman Owen Power. Free agency is going to be fun. You got where does Jack Eichel get traded to? What happens with Gabriel Landeskog? What happens with Vladimir Tarasenko? Alex Ovechkin should re-sign with Washington. You've seen teams make significant moves like the Flyers getting Ristolainen and Cam Atkinson. Ristolainen from Buffalo, Cam Atkinson from the Blue Jackets. The Avalanche re-signing Cale Makar to a 6-year deal. One of their better young players. But it should be exciting. It's kind of going to get lost in the shuffle with NBA draft this week and trade deadline in baseball, but hockey free agency could get interesting. Does Jack Eichel end up with the Rangers? I think that's going to be fun. So coming up in this next segment, I will be joined by a writer from the Hockey Writers who covers the Seattle Kraken, as well as you can find him as the co-host of the Third Line Podcast and good work covering minor league hockey. Adam Kierzenblatt will join me. We'll talk about that, and then we'll wrap up the show talking some football. Training camp underway, and the big story we've all been waiting for, and hopefully it'll come to some conclusion soon. We'll talk Aaron Rodgers, and we'll talk the big story about the NFL coming up with the forfeit policy this season. What it means, what do I think of it? But coming up next, we'll talk more hockey and more Kraken here on Kicking Them with Keeler after this. The NHL draft is this week, and what also was this week is the Seattle Kraken have players. They have a roster, and we get to talk about all those things this week with someone who covers the Seattle Kraken for the Hockey Writers. You can find him as the co-host of the Third Line Pod podcast. Also, there's a bunch of other things related to the NHL. He is Adam Kurzenblatt. Adam, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me this week.
Absolutely happy to have you. So before we get into the roster that the Kraken selected, just give me the buzz now with the Seattle team. They finally have a roster, and their schedule came out as well. They'll be playing in Vegas to begin in about, I think, October 13th. Now the buzz that the Kraken have a roster and the cool atmosphere they were able to create for this expansion draft.
So there's a lot of buzz around Seattle right now because they've been waiting so long to get their team. The expansion draft, now there was a little bit of question because what happened was that all of the picks basically got leaked. So who they were picking got leaked before the show. Mm-hmm. But the show was very cool. They did it with celebrities from Seattle, sports people who played in Seattle from all over the city. They had one player announced via the fish toss at the Pikes Peak Market. They had a player announced from Mount Rainier. So there is a lot of buzz going. The tickets aren't on sale yet, but I know that one thing that they're doing is because the stadium is not fully built yet, they're actually taking their training camp on the road to different places around the state of Washington. And that's causing a lot of buzz because a lot of the WHL teams that they're junior hockey league teams that they're using the stadiums for, they are offering like ticket packages so you can get tickets for WHL games and Seattle Krakens. So the buzz is pretty high. I'm in Vancouver here. There are a lot of people who are not very happy with the Vancouver Canucks at the moment. So there are quite a few people that love what the Kraken are doing from social side to activism side that have said, you know what, maybe I'm going to start cheering for the Kraken. So it's a very exciting time in the Pacific Northwest.
They had Marshawn Lynch even announce a pick, which I thought it was cool that he announced a pick that he couldn't really pronounce and he basically was trying to give up on it. But I thought it was a fun atmosphere. I'm with you though. I didn't like that. I get it's their job in a sense, but I didn't like the picks were revealed before the actual draft started because I'm taping it that night. I'm looking forward to watching, finding out who they're going to take. And then you're seeing throughout the morning that, oh yeah, they're going to take him. They're going to take him. Like, is that the NHL's fault in that they allowed that to slip out? Is anybody really at fault with that? Or is that just, you know what? It's the social media age we're in.
Well, it's the reporter's job. So Frank Cervelli, who works for Daily Faceoff, he's fantastic in his reporting. That's his job, is to get the scoop. If he gets the scoop, then more people on to look at Daily Faceoff. I know the NHL wasn't happy about it because they wanted it to be this big spectacle. But honestly, at this point, you can't get away with anything on social media. You can't make a signing. You can't make a trade without everybody knowing. For example, Vancouver made a major trade yesterday. Everybody knew about it about half an hour before the trade was finalized. So this is just the world we live in. It also allows fans to build up a little bit of hype around the expansion draft because now we know the players. Well, are these players going to be traded? So when we get into the roster a little bit, I can talk about some of the players that we thought were picked to be traded but actually weren't. So there is a little bit of intrigue. I know, Seattle probably wasn't happy. The NHL probably wasn't happy, but that's just the world we live in sports.
So let's get into the roster. And before we get into specific players, I know there were so many intriguing names like Carey Price, Vlad Tarasenko, Gabriel Landeskog, like all the stars were there. But for those that aren't familiar with it, Adam, take us through why those picks weren't exactly the best idea and how this process was going to go down with trying to make picks while also keeping under a salary cap.
So it's a very complicated situation with Carey Price. I can start with that one. Montreal, basically, before the expansion draft happened, all the teams had to release all the medical files for all of the players. Montreal said Carey Price is going to be visiting a specialist, but on Thursday, and the expansion draft was Wednesday. So if you don't know the future of a player, you're not really going to take him. Turns out he just had like simple knee surgery and he's going to be back before the regular season. And that was so that Montreal could protect their backup goalie, Jake Allen, who was projected to go to Montreal. In the case of Vladimir Tarasenko, he's only played about 30 games the last couple years because of injury. He has a massive contract at the moment. For the next 2 years, it's over $7 million. So even though Seattle has cap space, what their goal was with Tarasenko was they were going to bring him in and try to trade him, but teams didn't want to give up assets to Seattle because they learned from Vegas, which means that Seattle would have rather taken the player that they did from St. Louis in Vince Dunn, than Tarasenko because they weren't able to flip him. Gabriel Landeskog's a little bit of a different story. He's an unrestricted free agent, which means that there's no guarantee that Seattle was going to be able to re-sign him. So if they picked him, it might have been a wasted pick in that case. There's a couple other names. Braden Holtby of Vancouver, he's a goaltender. They were trying to flip him. It didn't work out, so they took another player. Philadelphia, they had a lot of quality players like Jacob Voracek and Robert Hägg, who could have gone, and we don't know why they picked who they did. They didn't pick any stars. So that one was a little bit of confusion. And then there's some intriguing players like Ryan Johansson, Matt Duchene, but they have massive contracts, so Seattle stayed away from that. But it seems like Seattle went into this expansion draft so that they could basically rebuild after year one if they really wanted to. They have a projected $30 million in cap space at the moment. They do have some restricted free agents to sign, but all in all, you know, that's going to take up maybe $6-7 million total. So this is really designed so that they can go out and make a splash in unrestricted free agency, or that they could take on bad contracts and acquire assets at the trade deadline or throughout the offseason if they really wanted to, like the Arizona Coyotes have been doing.
So while it's a little bit too early to determine the identity of a team, if you look at this roster, what would you say, Adam, is the identity of this team or what it's going to be known as, at least in year one, even though we still have most of the draft and free agency to go? With the expansion guys they have, what does this roster tend to lean towards?
This team is going to be very difficult to play against on the back end. They have one of the deepest D cores out there. You're going to have a first line of Mark Giordano and Adam Larson probably. So two very established veteran defensemen. Mark Giordano has won the best defenseman of the NHL award. And then you're going to have a guy like Jamie Oleksiak, who's 6'7". He's the brother of Canadian Olympian Penny Oleksiak. And then you're going to have the brothers in Hayden Fleury and Cale Fleury. We'll see if they can play together. Got guys like Carson Soucy, Jeremy Lazon, Vince Dunn, Dennis Shalowski. So this is a really, really deep D-core. And I'm curious to see if they're going to trade away some of their defense core because they definitely have too many players. The goaltending is going to be iffy. I'm not a big Chris Driedger fan, but I am a big Vitek Vanacek fan. Chris Driedger came over from Florida. They signed him for 3 years. We'll see. He's had one great year in the NHL, and that's it. But up front, there's going to be questions up front in the first two lines because their big star, Yanni Gourde, is going to miss a couple months due to surgery. But that third line, if they build it correctly, third line, we're looking at a guy like Mason Appleton, a guy like Brandon Tanev, and maybe a guy like Colin Blackwell, if that might be the best third line in the NHL. So this team is going to be very tough against, but they're going to be playing a lot of like 2-1 games, 3-2 games. Like, I don't expect this team to put up 5-6 goals against a game, but we also didn't expect that from Vegas. And William Karlsson had over 40 goal season in the first year. So it's very tough to determine what these players are going to be able to do. And for offense, it's really Jordan Eberle and Jonas Donskoy and Kelly Yarncroke. So you got three players you're going to rely on for offense, really.
Is that a position you think that Ron Francis could address in free agency with adding more goal scorers, or just trying to keep that cap space for maybe guys come up in trades or future years with free agency?
So I do think that Ron Francis has an opportunity to jump into free agency, but short-term free agency, really. So next year, it's a big crop of free agents that are going to come off the books. And I know we're in a flat cap world, but ESPN's new TV deal came in, so that might change the flat cap because there's a lot of money coming in, the addition of fans. But there are a lot of players that are interesting from a signing point this year if Seattle really wants to go all in. They got guys like, Alex Ovechkin is a free agent. He's not going to leave Washington. But once again, Gabriel Landeskog, if they can convince him to come over, that would be a good pick. Mike Hoffman, he's a goal scorer. He had kind of a down year, but he's still a good player. That's somebody that they could bring in. Or like a guy like Zach Hyman. He's rumored to Edmonton. That's probably not going to happen. Blake Coleman, again, that's a player. But it depends on if these guys want to come to an expansion team. If the idea of Vegas making the Stanley Cup final in their first year is enough to entice players to come to Seattle. Right now, the roster, from my perspective, isn't great, but it's still one of the top three rosters probably in the Pacific Division because the Pacific Division is so weak. And if players are going to take the idea of like what happened with Montreal this year, where all you need to do is get in and you have a chance, then Seattle can maybe make a splash and bring in some of these higher price free agents for a run in year one if they really wanted to.
So we know Vegas had the track record of making the Stanley Cup final in year one of expansion, which is really an unrealistic expectation because we never see expansion teams be that successful right out of the gate. So what is the expectation level for the Kraken in year one, especially as they were pointing out on the expansion draft telecast, they're in a division where most of these teams that they're going to be competing against are picking in the top 10 of the draft this weekend.
So when we look at the Pacific Division, Vegas is in there, so they're going to probably take the lead. Edmonton, even though they have Connor McDavid and they've added guys like Duncan Keith and potentially Zach Hyman, I think they're going to take a step back. They don't have a guy like Oscar Klefbom. They've lost Adam Larson, and Mike Smith is, I think he's 40 or he's over 40. He just signed a two-year deal. So I think that Edmonton might take a step back. Vancouver is such a wild card. We have no idea what they're going to be like next year. The roster is looking bad from a defensive point of view, but there's still time to fix it. So, and then you have Calgary, which is just kind of a mess. The only other team that I think could really make a difference is LA. So that's why a lot of people are saying that Seattle has a chance to make the playoffs, is because LA is this up-and-coming team that's going to have a lot of young players on their team. Anaheim is not a great team. San Jose is not a great team. So if you add all of that up, if Seattle can, you know, get a little bit of momentum early on, it's very possible they can make the playoffs just because there's so much uncertainty in the Pacific Division with teams that we don't know how they're going to play next year, if a lot of their players like Calgary are even going to be on the team next year. So this offseason is going to determine a lot, but Seattle, like I said, has a very good shot of making the playoffs in year one.
If you look at what the Kraken have done so far in the draft this weekend, they had the number two pick, which I still say, like, if you're an expansion team, you should get the number one pick to start off with, but they get the number two pick, and they select Matty Beniers from Michigan. Tell us a little bit about him, and could he be a guy that goes right to the team to start the season, or is he going to go to the NHL equivalent of the minor leagues to begin the season?
So as I'm aware right now, he's going to spend the next year at University of Michigan in the NCAA. I'm pretty sure that's already been confirmed. But Matty Beniers is going to be their second-line center of the future. This guy, his comparable is Jonathan Toews. So I don't know how many people remember how good Jonathan Toews was in the early 2000s. But this guy who can play two-way hockey, great. He's good in the defensive zone. He might not put up, 100 points, but he's going to get there between 70 and 80 points potentially a year. He's got a great shot. He also has competed for USA and done really well for the US team. And one part that I really like about his game is that he was invited to the World Championship this year. So as an 18-year-old, you're invited to play for Team USA, and you show up and you actually play well in one of the premier tournaments of the year. So not just against, you know, kids who are 18, 19, but we're talking about like NHL veterans, players who have played for a long period of time. He did get injured in that tournament and he didn't play much, but he played enough to really make an impact. Owen Power, who went first over to Buffalo, also played in that tournament. So if you are a Seattle Kraken fan, he's worth the wait for sure. I think also we're going to see a lot of these university players that, for instance, Owen Power has already said, first overall has already said, he's not going to play in the NHL next year. He's going to go back to University of Michigan. And I feel like that might be, you might see a lot of these prospects go back to either junior or university because they want that experience in their life. They didn't really get it the last year. They didn't get like the, you know, road trips or if you're in university, the dorm life. So they kind of want that experience. So going back to University of Michigan, not a problem for Matthew Beniers. And we'll see how he develops, but he is tracking very well, definitely.
So when you look at this roster, they have their coach in Dave Haxtell. How does this roster reflect the way he coaches?
Well, that's the question. Dave Haxtell, when he was with Philadelphia, he coached a really young team. This is a pretty young team. They're about 26, 27 years of age average. And there are some offensively talented players. And there are some players that we look at who could be potentially have offensive breakthroughs. So it really depends on how Dave Haxtell manages his bench. Now, he didn't have the most success in Philadelphia. He didn't really have playoff success. He went over to Toronto. They haven't made it out of the first round. So we're wondering how he's going to apply those lessons that he learned from missing the playoffs and from not making it out of the first round to Seattle. He's got a young team. He's going to have to bring everybody in, but Haxtell could provide some kind of he has a lot of experience. He knows some of the players already from times in coaching from university or the NHL. So we'll really see, but he could be a good choice, but it's very early to tell because I know this roster isn't fully complete yet. So it depends on how he manages his bench for sure.
So last question for you, Adam. When we look at the NHL this week, free agency is coming up at the beginning of this week, although with all the rumors, it tends to happen earlier than normal now. Is there a team outside of the Kraken you're looking forward to? What's the biggest free agency storyline you're watching?
Well, the biggest free agency story is Gabriel Landeskog. That's the player to watch. It looks like he's not going to end up back in Colorado. I think he's might be off asking for too much money, and Colorado just signed their big star Cale Makar to a $9 million contract this morning. So I don't know if Landeskog will be back. If he isn't back, the team to watch is the New York Islanders. The Islanders have cleared out about $20 million in cap space. We already know that they're going to go after Zach Parise, who is one of the best U.S. Players of all time, because he has a history with Lou Lamoriello, who's the GM from their time in New Jersey. I think they're going to also go after Ryan Suter, but I don't know if those two want to play together because they've been playing together for a long time in Minnesota before being bought out this year. So if they can get Parise and they can get Landeskog, that team is going to be a Stanley Cup contender right away. They got one of the best decors in the league. Their goaltending is solid. They got guys like Matty Barzell. They got guys like Andres Lee, Josh Bailey, Anthony Beauvillier, Oliver Wahlstrom. This team is stacked, and if they can add a Landeskog and a Parise, then that team might automatically become the Stanley Cup favorites in the betting world.
Yeah, the Islanders definitely have built a good core of players. It's been fun to watch them get to the conference final the last couple, third round conference final ever, the last couple of years. See if they can take that next step this coming season. Two quick ones for you, at least in terms of players to watch. Where do you think Tarasenko goes, if anywhere?
Tarasenko, I think he stays in St. Louis for this year. I think that his contract is too heavy to trade on with 2 years left. I think next year teams will be able to swallow the cap hit because there's only 1 year left. So I do think he stays in St. Louis because there's no team that wants to take his cap hit.
And the other one, for me at least looking at it, the guy's been on the block, it seems, a while. Didn't get moved on night one of the draft. Team had two picks after getting a first rounder from the Flyers, Jack Eichel.
So the talk is that that Eichel is going to the Rangers. I have trouble with that because the Rangers are in the same division as Buffalo. But if I'm Eichel, or if I'm Eichel's camp, there's two teams that I'm interested in: the LA Kings and the Vegas Golden Knights. So Vegas is, you know, they need center depth. They don't have a center. Chandler Stephenson is not a first-line center. He's like a third-line center, and he's right now playing between Pacioretty and Mark Stone. So that would be a great fit. LA Kings, you know, you got to play in LA. You got to be the face of that franchise. But they're asking a lot. They're asking for first-round picks, high prospects. And I know one of the players that they want back is Quinton Byfield, and that's a non-starter for LA. So it looks like the Rangers, you know, through what I've heard, that the Rangers, it might even happen as early as the next couple days that he goes to the Rangers. But for me, I don't see the Sabres trading him within the division because that makes very little sense, especially when you have to play them so many times and you know he's just going to burn them every time that he plays against them.
Yeah, that's strange too, why that trade would happen in the division, even though Buffalo, well, we should just call next year's draft like the Buffalo draft because they just got another first round pick from Florida. So maybe they're just going to make all the picks next year. But I was reading on Twitter today, I mean, how do you make that work with all the potential salaries Rangers have to pay? And then there was talk about maybe even Mika Zibanejad moving. To me, Zibanejad, while he had an off year this past year because he had COVID and been a difficult year for him, I don't get moving him because he's been one of the more consistent pieces on the team.
Well, people said the same thing about Buchnevich, and he mm-hmm. gets traded. So I think that the Rangers are in a very interesting spot here. You know, I think they realize that they can't compete just yet. Their window is going to start in about 2 to 3 years. But we'll see. They have guys like Kaapo Kakko. They have guys like Artemi Panarin, but they just don't have the strong decor. I know they have Adam Fox, they have like maybe two good forward lines, one good defensive line, and then maybe like a good goaltender. So I don't know if they're maybe looking at it like, let's try to move out salary. Let's try to build this team through free agency, or if there's something else, like, because if you're trading Mika Zibanejad, you're getting something big, and maybe that's why there's talk about Eichel, is maybe Buffalo really wants Zibanejad, and that's the player that's going to be coming back for him. That's the only thing that makes sense to me, why they would trade Zibanejad and Buchnevich for cap space, basically.
So, Adam, before I let you go, tell listeners out there about the work you're doing covering the Kraken for the Hockey Writers, the podcast that you do, and how they can follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, so I'm involved in quite a few things at the moment. My Twitter handle is @AdamKBlatt, so very simple compared to my last name. I'm covering the Kraken, and then I will be writing a little bit about the Vancouver Canucks for the Hockey Writers. We do have the Third Line podcast, which is Kraken and WHL themed. So if you are a junior hockey fan or you want to know about your prospects, that's where you can hear about us. I know the Rangers had one of the Vancouver Giants' former players, Ty Ronning. I think that he might not be re-signing with them, but That's a little bit of a connection between the Rangers and Vancouver. So I host that with somebody named Chris Waugh, Liz Child, and Jess Mosley, and it's a lot of fun. And then the last thing that I do is I write about the Vancouver Giants, and I cover them day-to-day for the a website called Dub Network, so D-U-B Network. And the Dub Network covers all things WHL. We look at the prospects. We look at the players. So if you are a junior hockey fan and maybe your team takes somebody in the seventh round that you've never heard of before, that is definitely a place to look at us. If you're an Ottawa Senators fan, they just took Zach Ospichuk, who's a Vancouver Giant. I have a lot of pieces about him on the on Dub Network. Braden Schneider, who was drafted by the Rangers, we have a lot of pieces about him on Dub Network from the time that he was 16 till now. So if you are into prospects, or if your team drafts somebody and you from the WHL and you're like, I want to get to know that player a little bit, that's the site to go to learn about what the players are doing on a daily basis and kind of their progress.
Be sure to check out all that work. I know covering minor league baseball that prospects are so important, and there's more information about prospects, not just in minor league baseball, but minor league hockey and things in the the professional ranks, but not the major levels. There's more coverage of that. Should always be encouraged. So be sure to read Adam's work on that, as well as the crack in this upcoming season. Adam, thanks for coming on. I will do this again soon. Thanks for the time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Special thanks to Adam Kierzenblatt from the Hockey Writers for hopping on to talk some Seattle Kraken. Always happy to get some insight on the Kraken. Going to be a fun team to watch this season as they begin their inaugural season in the NHL. So let's wrap it up with some football. And training camp underway. Sean Watson will be a training camp for the Texans, so you know that will be a big storyline for sure. But the big one I think everybody's going to follow is Aaron Rodgers, where I think when you look at the Packers, it's been a storyline that honestly I've been sick of. I hate it. I know people are so fascinated by it, where the reigning NFL MVP wants out. I'm tired of it. Maybe it's because I've heard it for about 3-4 months. And maybe because the NFL always needs to dominate the offseason, even though there's no games going on. And I think it's different because there's so much sports going on. Why we need to care about NFL drama in the offseason? But now it's the reckoning period. Training camp this week. Does Aaron Rodgers show up? Or, the interesting thing came out this week. Bill Huber of SI.com had the story. Multiple, and Pro Football Talk, multiple sports books believe Rodgers will announce his retirement before Wednesday's initial practice. Now, again, it's not official. No, it's not even close to being legitimately reported. It's just what's going on in Vegas. And you always know Vegas has the inside scoop a lot of the time. I don't think Aaron Rodgers is retiring. Because think about it. If he does retire and then unretires, the Packers still have his rights. I don't think Aaron Rodgers can really, and I think he's competitive enough to where he doesn't want to retire. He wants to keep playing. To me, this is where a sufficient holdout would happen, and I'm in a position in my fantasy league where I have him as a keeper option. I don't know what to do with him. I'm trying to figure out the rules. Like, if I keep him and he retires, what do I do with that? Do I get another keeper, or am I just losing a keeper because of it? So, to me, I think he's missing most of training camp. Then the Packers have to make a decision. Do they go with Jordan Love? Because to me, it's just simple. I know you might regret if you trade him, but if you can get 3 first-rounders and maybe get a player or two that help your team, make the deal. If you really want Jordan Love to play, what's stopping you from playing him if you don't want Aaron Rodgers on your team anymore? I know we've heard the compromise where, oh, agree that this will be my last season, then I can go wherever I want. I don't think the Packers want him to win, to be honest. Because they've already had so much egg on their face in this process. They want to win. The front office wants to beat Aaron Rodgers. Gutekunst wants the upper hand over him. Mark Murphy, the CEO, wants the advantage over him. Really, the one you've seen in Rodgers' camp more so is LaFleur, the head coach. Then you have this other storyline that made me, like, just sick of the story. So there's a report by Ian Rapoport this week that Devontae Adams' future is uncertain in Green Bay because they can't agree on a long-term contract. Well, Friday, Aaron Rodgers and Devontae Adams, on their Instagrams, posted a Scottie Pippen, Michael Jordan picture that was obviously familiarized people last year with The Last Dance. So are they both a package deal? Are they both going to the same place? Or what's going on? I get it. It's 2021. It's social media. You're all going to try to troll and create stories out of nothing. It's so dumb, to be honest. It really is. Because Devontae Adams isn't going anywhere. Especially if Aaron Rodgers isn't coming back. The Packers not trading Devontae Adams wherever he wants. No chance. He isn't in the final season of his contract, but they're going to try to see if he has good chemistry with Jordan Love. But it just continues to make the Packers look crazy. And honestly, I can't wait for this story to be over. I want to talk some on-field football. But Aaron Rodgers just keeps making headlines. And to me, if he came back right away, I would think this. I would honestly look at him differently because that would just be, why'd you just cause all this hoopla for over the last few months? The other big news in the NFL this week, Commissioner Roger Goodell on Thursday sent a memo to all the teams. Tom Pelissero from NFL Network was the first to have it, that if a team has a COVID outbreak due to non-vaccinated players, it could result in a forfeit. If an unvaccinated player or staff member is shown to have caused an outbreak that forced a schedule change, the team experiencing the outbreak will be held financially responsible for their club's expenses. The memo said if the game cannot be rescheduled, the team experiencing the outbreak will forfeit. Now, there are no mandates for vaccinations. Get this point across. Like, for those out there saying the NFL is mandating vaccines, no, they're not. And we've already seen two coaches. Rick Dennison, the assistant coach for the Vikings, was let go because he didn't want to be vaccinated. And you have the Patriots assistant coach, Cole Popovich, left the team this week. Get this straight. This is not a vaccine mandate. It's pressuring you to get it. It's not a mandate. The NFL, we learned this last year, is going to play its season however it can. They did not miss one game last season. They rescheduled some. We had the weird Ravens-Steelers Wednesday game, which I'm sure they want to avoid at all costs if they can. But vaccines are made available now. This isn't like last year where you couldn't just go up and get a vaccine. You had to kind of work things around because people couldn't get the vaccine. Now, whoever's gotten it is likely going to get it. If you haven't gotten the vaccine by now, who knows if you're going to get it? And I understand, look, I'm not telling you to do, like, it's a personal choice. We've talked about this on the show. I'm not telling you what you should do. But if you're a football player and you make that choice, you have to be cognizant of these are the things you have to follow. Your restrictions are going to be a lot more than people who are vaccinated. It's just the reality. And the league will fine players, I think it's like $14,000 and change, if they break those rules. They're serious about it. You can get, we saw DeAndre Hopkins frustrated about it. We've seen Cole Beasley frustrated about it constantly, and Cole Beasley tweeting stuff out that honestly, I don't know where he gets his news from sometimes. But those are the things you have to follow in order to have the season run as smooth as it is. And it's going to create divide in the locker rooms because if vaccinated players are going to try to convince non-vaccinated players to get vaccinated, or if you have those non-vaccinated players cause have the outbreak that leads to you forfeiting a game, you might cost your team a season. That in the NFL, losing a game is more critical than other sports losing a game because it's one out of like 82 or one out of 162. It's 1 out of 18. Or 1 out of 17 because it's 18 weeks. You can't afford those losses. And for a team to be, again, held financially responsible, I think it's going to hurt guys in the bubble if they're not vaccinated. Definitely. But I don't blame the NFL here. Look, the owners have the upper hand on the players' union. It's plain and simple. It's not like baseball where the players' union kind of has control, even though the owners got them in the last CBA, but you know that negotiation this offseason is going to come to blows. You have the NHL, where I think the players have the edge over the ownership. The NBA players definitely have the edge. Not in football. Definitely not in football. There were games last year that should have been played. I argued when Denver had Kendall Hinton at quarterback, that game should not have been played. Because I think it was not a game that was fairly competitive balance because Denver had really no quarterback. The NFL chose to play it. We can have an argument on a different show if you think that employers should require vaccinations. I'm not going to have that debate on this show. What I will say is, look, you can make that choice, but you have to realize if you decide not to, then you have to follow the protocols that are put in place by the NFL or whatever your employer is. With every choice comes a consequence, or every choice comes things you have to do with that choice. You still have to look out for other people at the same time. And I think sometimes we forget that, or some people forget that. They think because it's all over, they don't have to care for others that much anymore. But this topic caused a lot of controversy this week, and honestly, the NFL got it right. And college football is going to do the same thing. Look, if you have an outbreak and you don't have enough players to play, sorry, you forfeit. Because it's different if you have the outbreak among vaccinations, because you can still get COVID even if you're vaccinated. You just don't go to the hospital. You don't die. Like, don't get that confused. You can still get COVID if you're vaccinated. But if the outbreak is among vaccinated players, then yeah, you can probably then work around that and try to get a game scheduled if you can. If it's non-vaccinated, they're going to say, look, you had the opportunity to get it. You didn't get it. And you don't have to get it, but there's a consequence that comes with that sometimes. And again, it's not wrong if you don't get it. If you have a religious reason or a medical reason or things like that, believe me, I understand. It's a tough way to end the show, but I feel like we should end the show that way. Again, I think the NFL got it right, but I understand why people are upset. But just the way things have to go in 2021. So we'll be back next week. We'll talk trade deadline with baseball. We'll talk more hockey signings, basketball, NBA draft, more Olympics. Big news in golf with Bryson DeChambeau and Jon Rahm out of the Olympics due to COVID. Tennis, we'll see what Naomi Osaka does if Novak Djokovic wins the gold medal there to add to his great season. And we'll have some more fun with sports along the way with training camps opening up. We'll start to preview the football season in the coming weeks. Want to remind you can follow me on Twitter, @Rickinator555. That's @RICK, letter I, Nader like a Terminator, 3 5s. Follow us on Twitter, @FP_coverage, @FullPressRadio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Give it your podcast. Just search Kicking with Keeler. Chances are you will find it there. And be sure to download the Full Press Coverage app on your iOS or Android device. It is free. And you get all of our live shows, podcasts, articles, everything. It's just simply downloading the app. We would definitely appreciate it. Follow my other work over at Pinstripe Prospects. We do From the Backfield to the Bronx every week. This week will be our special trade deadline episode. We'll look at what Yankee prospects could be available in trades. We'll look at what the team should do. And all of our beat writers there are going to be covering what prospects could be traded from their respective teams they cover. So we'll mention that a lot this week over there. And over at Barrett Sports Media, I wrote up a couple of good articles this week. One that I wrote up involved First Take, Her Take, where the Kimberly Martin, L. Duncan, and Charlie Arnold got a question from a voicemailer about is asking a player about a personal event in their life out of bounds, i.e. when Chikari Richardson found out her mom died in an interview from a reporter. I found that interesting, so wrote about that. And Jared Carabas, David Ortiz, starting a new podcast in August. So I wrote about that as well. Thanks to all those who tuned in this week. Stay safe. Once again, I'm Ricky Keeler. Thanks for kicking with me, Ricky Keeler, on a Sunday. Thanks to Adam Kierzenblatt and Josh Neighbors for hopping on and talking about the Kraken and the Big 12. So I'm glad you kicked with me this week. I look forward to kicking with you next weekend. Thanks again, everybody.